I'm going to tell you a few things about experiments we have done in the field of damage and crack propagation in silicate glasses. Of course, Cindy Roundtree, who's here, and Danielle Bonamy, who's here also, have contributed greatly to the field, and as well as Silke Prad, who used to be our PhD student. But I want to say a few words about Claude, because unfortunately, he passed away last week. And I must say that if Claude had not been there to work with us, well, nothing of what I'm going to tell you would probably exist. So I wanted to say that as a sad introduction. So our group is mostly interested in mechanical properties, but not at the continuum scale, more within the scale of material heterogeneities. Material heterogeneities are easy to figure when it comes, for example, to metallic alloys. You have grain boundaries, sub-boundaries, second phase precipitates, point defects, dislocations. And you know that these heterogeneities arise at various then scales, up to scales, let's say, which would be on the order of 10 to a few hundred microns. When it comes to glasses, it's much more difficult to imagine what heterogeneities are. And we will see that the relevant heterogeneities in glasses are intrinsically linked to the amorphous structure. Hence, they really arise at very small length scales. And this is why observing and understanding the damage spreading and crack propagation mechanisms at these small scales took a lot of time. So that's what will be my talk today, to tell you about these mechanisms of damage formation and crack propagation at these small scales. But generally speaking, we are not only interested in observing and understanding these basic mechanisms, but also to include them into a statistical description, which hopefully could be the basis for more macroscopic models, which are the only ones to be predictive in terms of mechanical properties. And this could lead to elaborating new micro or nano structures, new glass compositions with better mechanical properties. And this, of course, emphasizes again the interest of looking at these damage and fracture mechanisms at the scale of the material heterogeneities. This is really how you can make better materials. One of the strong motivations for doing the work we've done is also that fracture exhibits some universal features that we really want to understand. In particular, and this is close to my heart, fracture surfaces exhibit universal morphological features. Of course, so universal meaning these parameters which enter into the description of the morphology of fracture surfaces do not depend on the material, they do not depend on its microstructure, and they do not depend on the loading conditions. But these universal features are observed generally within a material-dependent range of landscapes. And I will not say more about this, because Danielle Bonamy's talk tomorrow will be focused on that topic. But this is certainly one of our motivations. So if there are, on fracture surfaces, universal features, the question we have asked ourselves is, are there some relevant similarities? If the morphology of fracture surfaces for metallic alloys or silicate glasses or wood or cement, very, very different materials at very, very different landscapes, if there are similarities in this morphology, is it because there are similarities in the crack propagation modes at these scales? And up to what scales are these similarities relevant is also a question that we've been interested in. And finally, as you will see, the mechanism of damage formation and spreading in glasses has macroscopic consequences, which of course are, I think, of interest fundamentally, but also from the point of view of applications. So the outline of my talk will be the following. I will tell you about the experiments we've done, the observation of damage mechanism and the stress corrosion fracture of glass. We will see why stress corrosion. And we'll see also what these macroscopic consequences are. And finally, I will briefly conclude and tell you a few words about the work in progress in our lab. So the central point maybe of this presentation will be to tell you that at the scale of, let's say, between one and a few hundred of nanometers, glass is really non-homogeneous. It's a disordered material. And if you have a crack in a heterogeneous material which contains parts which are more or less brittle, then it is very unlikely that the first bond to break will be the bond close to the crack tip. Of course, this is the bond which undergoes the highest stress. Nevertheless, there will be bonds which will break before that one because they are more intrinsically brittle. So there is usually the formation of a damaged or process zone ahead of the crack tip. Its extent depends, of course, on the material and on the loading conditions. And sometimes these micro cracks will turn into cavities. And this is the second point. To turn into cavity, you have to have some plasticity. Plasticity in the sense of irreversible deformations. There needs not be a plastic flow like in the case of metallic alloys. But these irreversible deformations will really turn these microcracks into damaged cavities. And in glasses, we will see that it is likely to affect only very small nanometric length scales. So damaged cavities have been observed, of course, widely in metallic alloys. You have here the example of an in-situ scanning electron microscopy experiment. You have the main crack tip, and ahead of this crack tip, you see the opening of damaged cavities, which will join together and with the main crack, and this is how the crack proceeds. This is another experiment, aluminum-based alloy, and again, damaged cavities, which are this time observed with atomic force microscopy. In other materials, like wood, Eric Landis has studied damage ahead of a crack tip in wood. These damaged cavities can leave traces on the fracture surfaces, and this is what Ravi Chanda has observed on PMMA. You see here the fracture surface with the trace of these damaged cavities. This is also what Fabrice Lapic has observed on polyethylene. And more recently, Xi and co-workers have observed the fracture surfaces of metallic glasses, and they have observed the trace again on these cavities on here, two different metallic glasses. What is interesting here is also that you see that this glass has a fracture toughness of 2 MPa square root of meter. This glass is 10 MPa square root of meter. And I believe that the range of landscapes where damage is observed is probably related, it is related obviously to the microstructure, to the structure of the glass, and hence to the fracture toughness. Of course, in simulations, there have been hints that this cavitation actually existed in glasses. There is, of course, Mike Falk's work on Lennard-Jones glasses, where you clearly see the formation of cavity ahead of the crack tip. And this cavity will join with the crack, and this is how the crack progresses. Other numerical results, porous material with Lennard-Jones interaction by Oradou and co-workers, shows again this formation of damaged cavities ahead of the crack tip. Now, without a crack in pure tension, you have the study by Lawrence and co-workers where you see here in pure tension the nucleation and growth of a void. So this seems fairly general. Again, other examples by Nakano and co-workers on amorphous silicon nitride. And you see, I put the two images. This is experiment on the metallic alloy. This is the simulation on the amorphous ceramic. And you can see, really, the similarity and the damage formation on these two examples. And you can see also the main difference. When we are at the scale of 30 microns in the case of the metallic material, they are at the scale of 3 nanometers in the case of the molecular dynamic simulation. So Cindy Rountree and Rajiv Kalia have also done that kind of simulations on amorphous silica. And as you can see again, see maybe not that clearly because of the quality of the image, you see a damage formation ahead of the crack tip again. So our idea was really, can we experimentally see this cavity formation ahead of a crack tip in a silicate glass? And the idea is really to follow the crack. So we already know that we have to be at very small length scales, let's say between one and a few hundreds of nanometers. So for glass, it would be atomic force microscopy studies. And then we want the crack to go very slowly, because if we choose atomic force microscopy, then it takes a few minutes to make an image. So you don't want your crack to cross completely your zone of observation while you are scanning your sample. So this limitates us to very, very slow crack propagation rates. And this is why we have chosen stress corrosion cracking. Although, of course, stress corrosion is a very interesting topic in itself. But mostly these are the only cracks that we can follow in situ. So what is stress corrosion? If you have a stress intensity factor here, this axis, which is lower than K1C, the fracture toughness, and you are in a vacuum, your crack will not progress because the load is not enough. Now, if you are in a humid environment, water molecules can come and hydrolyze the SiO bonds and help the load to make a crack progress in the material. So stress corrosion is a subcritical crack growth mode. It is for stress intensity factors which are smaller than the fracture toughness. And you usually distinguish two stages, let's say three. Well, the third one is really coming close to the fracture toughness. But let's say two stages. In the first stage, in fact, and we have reproduced Videon and co-workers' results, the velocity as a function of the stress intensity factor behaves like this, which is really an Arrhenius law. It tells you that, in fact, the chemical reaction is a thermally activated process, and the activation energy is really the elastic energy. In stage two, the phenomenon is really controlled by the diffusion of water. It's no more controlled by the chemical reactions, but by the diffusion of water. So we have, in fact, decided to focus on crack progressing within stage one at velocities which are close to the picometer per second, with a purely technical limitation to the nanometer per second. So very, very slowly propagating cracks. The experiment is the following. We have these glass bars, small samples, 2.5 centimeters. They are classical samples used to study the fracture of glass. They have a hole drilled in their middle, and they are subjected to uniaxial compression. And when you do that, you have two cracks which emerge symmetrically from the cylindrical hole, and both of them are in fact subjected to mode 1 tension, although globally it is a compression. So what we have done is come to look now on this side. On this side, this is what you see. So the hole and two cracks symmetric with respect to the hole. And we have focused with an atomic force microscope on one of these crack tips and looked at what we were seeing. So now, I hope the movie is going to work. We had a few problems. What you will see is the first experiment we have done in that context. And this was a collaboration with Montpellier University. We have been studying a fairly complex glass, an aluminosilicate with lithium. And you will see the crack coming from the left of the image. The color code is the following. The blue is the average height. And then when you see green, it means a depression. So let us go. The crack is coming from here, and you see the opening of small cavities. Tape again. Small cavities, small depressions ahead of the main crack tip, which coalesce together and with the main crack, and this is how the whole zone of observation is broken.
What's the scale of the depression that one is seeing? So
it's 1 to 2 nanometers, and our samples, of course, are polished much better than this. So this is in terms of depth. In terms of size of the cavities, it's around 20 nanometers, let's say, in length, and 10 nanometers in width. You see that this is 75 nanometers, the zone of observation. One important point, so the average crack velocity in this case was 3.10 to the minus 10 meter per second. So we have wondered if, of course, because disorder is very important, if it was because this glass was quite complex that we could see this damage formation. So we have decided to take the simplest glass we can think of, which is amorphous silica. And as you will see, well, the phenomenon is the same. You have here the main crack tip, and you see the formation of a cavity ahead of this crack tip, which joins with the main crack, and this is how you break the zone of observation. In this case, it's 350 nanometers, and as you have seen, the cavity is much, much larger than in the previous case. So, of course, I'm sure there is an effect of the material, of the glass composition and structure, but there is also an effect that we have tried to understand of the average crack velocity. Before we go into discussing this size of the cavities, I want to tell you that, of course, this is really a cavity that we have seen ahead of the crack tip, in the sense that it has undergone irreversible deformation. This cavity is printed on the two crack lines. This is the last image of the movie. What we have done is used the Frasta method, which was invented for metallic materials, and by pulling the two crack lines extracted from only the last image of the movie, we could go backwards in time and compare with the actual movie that you have seen before. And this is what happens. So we go back in time. This is the reconstruction. This is the experiment. So you see that we are able to reproduce what happened during the experiment, but you can notice also that the cavity that we see through the reconstruction is much thinner than the cavity observed during the experiment, for the reason that in the experiment you have the elastic part of the deformation plus the plastic part of the deformation, and in the reconstruction case, of course, this is not true.
Can I ask a question about that? Presumably you're getting water down to this opening. How's the water getting there?
So that's, of course, a very important question. Of course, at the surface, we don't have this problem because we are in the humid environment. But within the bulk, water has to penetrate. And if you take the diffusion coefficient of water in silica, you will not, certainly water doesn't have time to go through 100 of nanometers. But this, and there is a beautiful series of experiments by Tomozawa, you can see that under stress, the diffusion of water is enhanced, and then you can really say that your water is able to penetrate over 100 nanometers within the bulk.
Within the crystalline, well, not amorphous.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not going through the amorphous. It's going along the cracked surface, right?
Yes, but then you have to account for the opening of the cavities. So it has to go really a lot inside the material, but because there is a high tension there, then you can have this diffusion through large landscapes.
So it just reduces some of the friction coefficient somehow nearby the water when it goes there, or
what do you mean?
No, how do the crack starts to formate there due to the thing that the water pressure sort of reduces the frictional strength on the.
The idea we have about it, I'm not sure it's completely non-controversial, but the idea I have is that you have these SIO bonds which are more or less stretched, and if they are sufficiently stretched, then the water molecules will come and hydrolyze these bonds. They will cut the bonds. So under these very moderate stresses, you have to have water molecules to help breaking the bonds. Otherwise, it won't work. So let's come back to the size of the cavities at coalescence. And let's imagine that, so at these scales, glass is a very disordered material, and that you have sort of more brittle regions with a density rho zero, typical distance between these regions d zero. And now you want to know which ones of these regions are going to actually develop into microcracks. So the way I view stress corrosion, it's easier to break, but it's less probable. Really, for these sites to be, in fact, to become microcracks, you have to activate the chemical process, so that if now among these sites you look for the density of microcracks, of activated sites, then it becomes a density rho, and the ratio of rho and rho zero is simply the exponential in which enters the activation energy for stress corrosion, that is the elastic energy. So, of course, you can replace this by the ratio of the velocity to this prefactor and see that finally the probability of breaking in stress corrosion is inversely proportional to the average crack velocity. Now, when you go from stage 1 to stage 2, control parameter is really becomes the diffusion of water, and the chemical reaction is no more the limiting factor, which means that for V equals velocity at the onset of stage 2, then rho is equal to rho zero, and then you end up with a size of cavity at coalescence which is invertly proportional to V, and the prefactor makes sense. Why? Well, in dynamic fracture, we don't have any stress corrosion, so we believe Cindy Roundtree's results, and she tells us that D0 is of the order of 1 nanometer, which makes sense if you think of the size of rings of tetrahedra of silica in the glass. So then, if you go to stress corrosion, you think of our first experiment, velocity 10 to the minus 10 meter per second, you find cavities of 40 nanometers at coalescence. The second experiment concerning pure silica, 10 to the minus 11 meter per second, gives you a cavity size of roughly 100 nanometers. So these are correct orders of magnitude. Of course, I think there has to be something depending on the glass structure, the glass composition in the prefactor. So actually, 40 nanometers is a little larger than what we observe on the aluminosilicate.
So if I think of D0 as being a nanometer, then that basically means that there are low fracture toughness regions in every ring, right?
Yep.
So at that point, why can't I also think of it as a homogeneous media with nucleation occurring at every site? Once the density becomes that high, you're not somehow meeting a very broad distribution of strengths. And there's nothing in this argument about that either, about fiber or calcium or anything, right?
Yeah.
So,
well,
large heterogeneities in magnitude or size.
Yeah, you...
But is this process thermally activated?
Yes.
So, therefore, it could be due to basically thermally, you know, growth of nucleation, like in bubbles or something, that is really that kind of process. So you get sites that are excited by the thermal...
Precisely. It suggests that the thermal heterogeneity is more important somehow than the intrinsic mechanical heterogeneity. And you're just anywhere it can be a site and just some happen to get nucleated.
Yeah.
Your point is that you're not even not doing the diffusion because you just stress punctuation in several sites.
No, I didn't mean to be saying that, too, because I would think that the barrier for the diffusion is, the barrier to me strongly depends on the presence of water. So, and it may well be that the diffusion itself creates heterogeneity in terms of nucleation.
That can be, but the... In the case of the simulations, you don't have water at all entering the picture. It's really and mechanically she applies a stress and she sees the opening of these cavities also at much much smaller length scales, but she also sees that. So then that the probability of breaking in stress corrosion would depend on different factors. This is a very, of course, macroscopic approach, and but the fact that there are bonds which will break at these scales even without the action of water is what Cindy observes in simulations also.
Much bigger stresses and much higher velocity.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, just mention one mechanics thing that may or may not be relevant. It looks like all the crack tips are somewhat blunted. And if you look at a blunted crack tip, the peak stress concentration of that is removed from the crack tip. And you have an enhancement of the hydrostatic stress there. So that's kind of pushing things to happen away from the crack tip, and it's typically two to three of those radii. It seems not too different from what you saw in the experiment.
Yeah.
And that means, I guess, you want to push the heterogeneities into the area there because the barrier would be higher near the crack tip because actually the stresses are somewhat lower there because of the blunting.
Unfortunately, we don't have enough resolution to actually look quantitatively at the blunting of the crack tip, but that would be interesting. So, microscopic consequences. We have looked at the outer plane deformation around the crack tip in both the aluminosilicate case, so this is the crack. You can see or guess a sort of depression ahead of this crack. And this is, of course, at a much much larger scale. It's 1 micron by 1 micron, so than the previous images. If you expect a linear elastic low, then it will tell you that the outer plane deformation should behave like something like the distance to the crack tip to the minus 1/2. And this is actually what we observe experimentally, but only quite far from the crack tip. And how much far? It's easier to see on the log-log plot. 80 nanometers if you are looking at the outer plane deformation along the direction of crack propagation. And same kind of behavior if you look at a direction perpendicular to the direction of crack propagation, but this sort of plateau does not extend more than 20 nanometers here. And it looks like this sort of departure from linear elasticity arises within the damage zone, which, if you remember the first movie, is about 20 over 80 nanometers. Same thing in pure silica, but this time, and it goes like the size of cavities, this departure from linear elasticity extends along the direction of crack propagation up to 280 nanometers for this specific velocity. Cindy again has done these MD simulations with a free surface. She has a notch. She can see the depression like what we have in experiments. And she measures the outer plane deformation. This is along the direction of crack propagation. You see that she gets back the 1 over square root of r dependence after a distance of 10 nanometers from the crack tip. Same thing in the other direction. But what Cindy could do, and we couldn't, is actually say, yes, it is within that zone that you have the opening of cavities. For this, Cindy has calculated the cumulated porosity. That is, she has calculated the amount of void she has up to a distance r from the crack tip. This quantity, as long as you have voids forming within the region, this quantity increases, and then you expect that it will decrease as 1 over r. And so she has done that. Here are her results, and you see that this point, so the distance to the crack tip where you have the opening of cavities, is around 10 nanometers, exactly where she sees the departure from linear elasticity. So we are pretty convinced that this process zone that we define from the out-of-plane displacement behavior is really the zone where you have the opening of damaged cavities. We have measured this process zone size both in the direction of crack propagation, these are the triangles here, and perpendicularly to it. The perpendicular size of RC, of the process zone size, is fairly constant, while in the direction of crack propagation, in fact, it decreases with increasing the crack velocity, and the decrease is well fitted by a log. Although we don't have any simple explanation for this. But we've been talking a lot with Ravi about orders of magnitude of this process zone size. So imagine you have a cavity at a distance L from the crack tip. Well, this cavity will open and grow if the stress field felt at the tip of the cavity is larger than the intrinsic strength of the material that we'll call sigma star. So if you want to write the stress at the tip of the cavity, you have, of course, to multiply the K1 over square root of 2PL by 1 plus 2R, where R is the aspect ratio of the cavity. This gives you an expression of the process zone size, which is defined as when the two stresses are equal. And now we have computed some orders of magnitude. It is easy to believe from simulations and observations that the aspect ratio should be of the order 1:2, order unity. In dynamic fracture, the intrinsic strength was measured to be 12 gigapascals. And the stress intensity factor is, of course, close to the fracture toughness of glass, which is 1 MPa square root of meter. And this gives you process zone size, which is between 10 to 40 nanometers. And I've shown you that this is very close to what Cindy is observing. Now, in stress corrosion, there have been measurements also of this intrinsic strength sigma star, which I was telling you that it's easier but less probable to break in stress corrosion. Easier in the sense that, of course, this intrinsic strength is really decreased, and the stress intensity factor is the stress intensity factor in our experiments, 0.4, 0.5 MPa square root of meter. And this gives you a process zone size between 15 and 100 nanometers, which is a good order of magnitude.
I'm confused here, but maybe you're for the same reason.
Well, yeah.
Well, I don't know, maybe it's not, but what this predicts is that fracture first takes place right at the crack tip.
Yeah. I mean, yes, except if you don't have a heterogeneity, which is there.
But if you can govern, it should occur there. I mean, that's where the water is going to be first, will be near the crack tip.
Yeah, but you have to have the once again, the SIO bond has to be stretched enough.
Stretched for the strength?
No, but there is a stretching, a sort of pre-stress of the material, just because in the amorphous structure not all the bonds are equivalent.
I may be extrapolating incorrectly, but there were discussions like this in relation to void growth in metals.
Mm.
There's an old paper by Jim Rice and George Johnson, I forget the guy, Johnson and Rice. It's, anyway, they looked at void growth,
mm-hmm.
Just a sort of picture like this. But what they found is that it's actually counting for the crack tip one thing was very important in that, and that shifts the peak away.
Mm-hmm.
In order of magnitude estimates, they probably wouldn't be very different, but it plays mm-hmm. a key role in getting things away from happening right at the crack tip. Was in the same thing with metal plasticity, you never see the voids growing right at the crack tip.
Yeah, I believe that, but how much a crack tip in glass would be blunted? And
probably the size of the void.
The same argument, argument can be used to calculate the blunting, because basically what this says, if you forget the plus 2R, this says that the length scale at which the stress, given by the stress intensity factor, approaches the ideal strength of the material is this L that you've calculated. Therefore, we know that within that length scale, mm-hmm. the elastic picture fails. Something new must happen, and there will be structure and change over that length scale.
Okay.
And the same argument could be used to say the crack will be blunted over this length scale as to say that something will happen some distance away. You can't, without knowing more about material properties, say, I think, what will happen in that length scale. All you know is elastic theory fails.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Which promotes void growth.
Yeah. No, that's very true, but there are maybe two things. That how far is the maximum of the stress? That's the question, what you just mentioned, Alan.
I have a couple slides. I think you can guess it pretty much from these results. It'll tell you, I was doing a quick calculation.
Yeah.
It looked like the crack hit, just from her plot of the porosity, I would say it's about 2 nanometers.
Okay.
The opening, I would guess, just from that, it's about 2 nanometers.
But that's about water and that's about...
Right, right.
About
the dynamic pressure. So.
But how would we see... opening of cavities on 200 nanometers. I mean, it's the order of... Yeah, 2 nanometers.
For her case.
Yours is
20
nanometers.
Yeah. Yours is... I mean, you can calculate it from here.
Yeah, 20 nanometers. But, yeah. To have a 250 process node.
According to my theory, probably it's a calculation to a very important question. This question is a form. It's a limited question, according to my theory. Stress intensity factor conception is a consequence of the existence of some similar solution as the intermediate asymptotical solution, which was formed by bioblast in purely elastic materials. We have such similar solution. As a consequence, we can use a stress intensity factor as characteristics of main crack opposition. In the presence of voids or micro cracks or some porosity at the cracked zone, it's possible, and we show that it's a physical platform argument, there is another subsequent solution which corresponds to generation of dot cracks, mm-hmm. or porosity, or some electric phenomena in the microcrack sample. And according to my theory, this objection to the second type of attractor of the similar solution could be the reason for these characteristics, scale, concentric perpendicular direction, and site of crack zone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll discuss more about that.
Because in the dynamic experiment, we discovered two types of attractors. Mm-hmm. One responsible for stress intensity factor, and the second responsible for damage accumulation of porosity collective behavior as a crack zone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anyway, these are order of magnitudes, and obviously both the aspect ratio and the intrinsic strength would depend on the crack velocity through the stress intensity factor. And furthermore, you really have to account there for the diffusion of water, because the size of cavities that we have discussed before can be discussed without thinking too much of the diffusion of water, because we are looking at the free surface. But the way here we define the process zone size, it is really from the outer plane deformation, which means that the bulk of the material is contributing to this outer plane deformation. And so this is a very crude sort of way to get order of magnitude. So, of course, if you don't account for this aspect ratio of the cavities, you have still an elastic field. So except at the tips of the microcrack, where plastic deformations can occur, I believe that you have an elastic behavior. We have looked also into the kinematics of cavity growth. Again, the last image of our movie on pure silica with the crack. And we are, again, going back into time along this line. What we want to do is to look at the trajectories of these various fronts. So we have gone back into time. So we have the cavity with her two fronts, C and B, and A is the main crack front. So we go back again in time, and we have only point A. So this is the height along the x-axis. And now we have plotted the trajectories of points A, B, and C as a function of time. Time is this axis going downwards. So this is the initial image of the movie. You have only a crack tip. So green is again a depression. So this is the main crack tip. There is no cavity ahead. And at one point you will see the cavity appearing with its two fronts. And at longer times you will have the coalescence with the main crack. Which means that we can now plot the positions of these various fronts as a function of time. So the main crack front and the rear front of the cavity. This is, of course, the coalescence time. And this is the forward front of the cavity. What can be noticed is that the cavity fronts are going faster, not an order of magnitude faster, but three times faster than the main crack tip. And this is sort of an image which, for me, is sort of intermediate between what would happen for metals, where cavities would grow toward the crack front, and with micro cracks in a brittle, purely brittle material, where the main crack would go toward the micro crack. So it's a sort of intermediate situation. But what is more interesting is that I told you that in this experiment the main crack front was going at 3×10⁻¹ⁱ meter per second. While I'm telling you that here it is going 3×10⁻¹২ meter per second. There's a factor of 10 between the macroscopic observation and the observation where, at the scale where you see the cavities. Why? Well, because this is what happens to the main crack front. It evolves with time until it meets a cavity. Then it jumps by the size of the cavity again, will go slowly and jump again, and what you see macroscopically is the average of this. And so, of course, we believe that for applications this is interesting if we manage to understand what triggers the size of the cavities at coalescence. So in conclusion, we have been studying stress corrosion damage in glass. We have evidenced the formation of damage at nanometric length scales. We have seen the opening of damaged cavities, and we believe that damage spreading is due to the intrinsic disorder of the amorphous state, and that microcracks turn into cavities due to localized plasticity. So we have this formation of cavities. And that process has macroscopic consequences in terms of nonlinear elastic deformations, which are observed on unexpectedly large scales, a few hundred of nanometers. And the sample lifetime may probably be improved if we really understand more quantitatively this mechanism. So the work in progress in our lab these days, of course, all that I have shown to you are surface experiments. So we really want to have a fully 3D description of damage. And this, well, we have not found at least any way to get it rather than to look into post-mortem fracture surfaces and analyze the mismatch between the two surfaces. So this is what we are actually doing, and probably by the end of the week we would have the first results in 3D. And we want to understand, of course, what is the link with the glass structure. Cavities versus microcracks, and how can the glass deform irreversibly is, of course, a question of interest. What are the structural changes under stress? What triggers cavity extension? And what are the implications for the kinematics of cavities? This is something that will be addressed mostly through molecular dynamics simulations, and we are working, of course, Cindy is working with colleagues at USC and also with colleagues at the Mixed Lab CNRS Saint-Gobain, Stéphane Roux and Damien van den Broek. And of course, we are also trying to understand what are the implications of such a mechanism on the morphology of fracture surfaces, but this you will know tomorrow after Daniel's talk. Thank you for your attention.